next segment of the evening, which focuses on decentralization. So Professor Werner, Catherine Austin Fitz, you will both be sticking with us for this next segment, but I would like to introduce two additional guests, including Dr. Patrick Wood and Dr. Mark Skidmore. Dr. Mark Skidmore is professor of economics at Michigan State University, where he holds the Morris Chair in State and Local Government Finance and Policy. His research covers topics in public finance, regional economics, and the economics of natural disasters. Mark created the Lighthouse Economics website and blog to share economic research and information relevant for navigating tumultuous times. Dr. Mark Skidmore, thank you for joining us today, and it is a pleasure to have you here with us.
Thank you, Taylor. Can you hear me?
Yes, and you may go ahead with your presentation.
All right, very good. So I just want to say thanks to Doctors of COVID Ethics for pulling all this together. One of the great great things that has come out of all of this is that we're finding each other and we're using these mechanisms to communicate ideas and across different fields. I'm an economist, as Taylor mentioned. I do work in public finance as well as economics of natural disasters. And I can say that, we do have pandemics, and in the past, there have been many pandemics that have, within countries, or epidemics that have had negative impacts on economic activity. The largest one in the last 125 years is the Spanish flu of 1918 and 19, where an estimated 8 million lives were lost. I can say in my assessment, COVID is not a pandemic by a traditional definition. We know this for the reasons that we have been discussing today and will continue to discuss over the next tomorrow. We know that the World Health Organization changed the definition of a pandemic to reduce removing severity and high mortality criteria. We know that we've had inflated infections from the PCR test, as was discussed today. We now know that there are numerous effective treatments available for COVID that are safe, and that it has been known that there are safe treatments for coronavirus for some time now. We also know that the definitions, at least in the United States, I think this may be true for other countries as well, the definition of a COVID fatality changed from having died from COVID to died with COVID. And so we have a difficult standard for infections. We all have a difficult standard in terms of assessing the true number of fatalities from COVID, though I think we are having real fatalities. But from what statistics we have, the survival rate is very high at about 99.7% overall. We also know that people with underlying health conditions and the elderly are far more susceptible. In some of my own work looking at aggregate fatality data across countries, I found consistent with what was discussed today is that PCR testing is associated with more infections, but not associated at all with more fatalities. Countries that have more elderly and greater obesity have more fatalities. The policy factors implemented across countries in different ways, lockdowns, travel restrictions, and masking had little effect on or no effect on fatalities. The only policy factor was whether or not a country made HCQ available. In our estimates with my co-author Hideki Toya, we estimate that fatalities would be about 16% less if we had just made that available. And we know, for example, in the United States, it was not made available, it was suppressed. And not that HCQ is necessarily the best treatment, but it is a treatment that was available and not used. In terms of consequences, we have to make a distinction between COVID and the illness and the lockdowns and restrictions. In my assessment, nearly all of the social and economic impacts are associated with the lockdowns and the restrictions. We have unnecessary lives lost from COVID due to suppression of effective treatments. We have limited access to treatments. If you're fearful and you're not going into the doctor for your regular checkup, we know that cancer, for example, is going to be more likely. And so we're going to experience more fatalities over time because people were afraid or their healthcare access was limited during this time. In the United States, the CDC estimates that suicide among teenage girls was up 51%. We saw suicide rates increase in the UK and Australia and other countries as well. Alcohol and drug related fatalities, according to the CDC, is up 30%. Tremendous loss of life. Life expectancy in the United States for the first time since World War II went down about 1.5 years. For minorities, it really dropped much more, about 3 years. And I would make the case, and I think others, I think the data support this, it's not COVID fatalities per se that is leading to this, but the lockdowns and the restrictions that were imposed. In the developing world, the UNICEF just recently published a report estimating that up to 40 million children over the next decade will experience wasting and malnutrition. Data show that between 10 and 18% of children experiencing wasting will die. So that's huge losses that we will anticipate. Human capital is the most, most economists agree. Physical capital is important for being productive as well as technology, but human capital is the thing that is most important. And economists and policymakers will be studying for a long time the losses in educational attainment associated with going purely online overnight. And of course, the lower income families that have fewer resources are going to be, the children of those families will be most affected. Social capital has also been affected. This is a more intangible item, but if we are afraid of one another and we don't talk to one another, and there's mistrust or fear of being infected, it creates a friction within communities. And this is happening on a huge scale with regard to the vaccinated versus the unvaccinated. We really need to work to improve this situation so that we can continue to have those relationships that really is sort of a lubricant for a local economy. In terms of the other economic impacts, that erosion in faith of institutions, which I would say is probably something that needed to happen. We've had failed businesses in the United States. It varies from place to place, state to state, depending on the situation. In the Bay Area, it's estimated about 40% of small businesses failed and are not expecting to return. We do have new business development as well, but at tremendous cost. As we just discussed with Professor Warner and John Titus, we've had massive monetary injections and government borrowing. That's not costless. Inflation is on the rise. Other consequences will emerge. In summary, we have some people who say most people would probably agree with the statements that I just made, but it would be attributed to the pandemic. And if that is true, it's tragic, but there's not much that we can do other than try to be cooperative. But if it's more than that, it's not just fraud, but a planned event where lockdowns and restrictions are known not to be effective, where there is a purposeful suppression of alternative treatments, where there is a deception on a massive scale in order to achieve other means. And these people are thinking of these human losses and casualties and economic losses as a cost of doing business. Then I think we probably need to call it something else if you think that. It looks more like a Holocaust. Ralph Waldo Emerson once said, people only see what they are prepared to see. And so I think the importance of this symposium is to help people see what is happening. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Mark Seymour. I would now like to introduce our next guest, Dr. Patrick Wood. Dr. Wood is a leading and critical expert on sustainable development, green economy, Agenda 21, 2030 Agenda, and historic technocracy. He is the author of Technocracy Rising, the Trojan Horse of Global Transformation, and co-author of Trilaterals Over Washington, Volumes 1 and 2, with the late Anthony C. Sutton. Patrick remains a leading expert on the elitist Trilateral Commission, their policies and achievements in creating their self-proclaimed new international economic order, which is the essence of the sustainable development on a global scale. Wood is the publisher of Technocracy News and Trends and founder of Citizens for Free Speech. Dr. Wood, welcome to the stream and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Taylor. I really appreciate it. Great to be with you all. I'm going to try and raise the horizon just a little bit as we talk about technocracy. And there's not a lot I can add to the particulars that have already been presented. It's great stuff. I agree with Mark that just being able to kind of interact and hear these things, just fantastic, make new connections and so on. But I want to go back to just slide back into the 1930s just briefly to point out that this is where the concept of technocracy was really crystallized. It was active before that, but it really kind of came together in the early 1930s during the heat of the Great Depression. A group of scientists and engineers at that time believed, mostly at Columbia University, believed that capitalism was dead and that it was up to them to create a brand new economic system, and they did. They called it technocracy by name. I'm not going to go through all the history on that, just a document. This is a historical fact. It's there. There's plenty of information out there on it. I documented a lot of it in my books on technocracy, by the way, which are pretty much available in bookstores around the world. But over the course of years, the marketing name for technocracy has changed, and the people that have handled it have changed as well. There was no institutional support back then in the 30s for it. There is today. There's lots of big money following after this concept of technocracy. It is the only replacement economic system the world has ever known. I'd like to be challenged on this, but I've never found another one personally that that was built from scratch. It's a resource-based economic system. It's not price-based. It's not supply and demand-based. But it's very technical and it's very specific that it's going to be based on mostly accounted for on the use of energy instead of money. This is an otherworldly type of an economic system, and I've been tracking it for 45 years now through the auspices of globalization. But as the marketing names have changed, the ones you might be familiar with today are things like sustainable development, like green economy, like the Green New Deal. Natural capitalism is another term I've heard floated around. But the major concept is in sustainable development, which is promoted, of course, by the United Nations. And sustainable development is a resource-based economic system like technocracy. We could call it neo-technocracy today just for the sake of distinction between the time periods. But the markers of the two systems are very similar. There's very little has changed over the last decades. And this group of actors has continued kind of below the surface, slipped into society to get into a position of control. And they have now been successful at doing that. And when I say another column of actors, I'm talking about the technocrats who believe that science is the only way to control everything in society, that all other systems of thought, philosophy, religion, et cetera, is of no repute to them. If it can't be demonstrated by science, they don't want to have anything to do with it. In the 1930s, technocracy was defined very succinctly as the science of social engineering. And it stated that it wanted to control the production and distribution of goods to the entire population, everyone in the population. They also wanted to say that there's no place for politics in technocracy. They wanted to get rid of the politicians. They wanted to get rid of the finance and financiers and so on as they knew it back then. And so it was very antithetic towards government per se. We see this working into society today, where many of the big tech conglomerates now are more powerful than many countries are. And countries are now bowing to them rather than the other way around. I would point out that Christiana Figueres, who is the former head of the climate change effort at the United Nations, she was the one that organized and hosted the Paris Climate Change Agreement convention. She said in a press conference shortly thereafter, this was documented in Europe as well, as by, for instance, Forbes magazine and several places in the media. She said, this is the first time in the history of mankind that we are setting ourselves the task of intentionally within a defined period of time to change the economic development model that has been reigning for at least 150 years since the Industrial Revolution. This was really the first admission by the United Nations that they had a marker, they had a target on the back of free market economics and capitalism throughout the world. She mentioned they have a timeline, that they have an agenda, that they have an intention to do this. This is not just a conspiracy theory. This is what Christiana Figueres said. And since then, I have been watching very carefully to see for the signs of when this timeline would be activated. When would this all kind of come to pass? And now we see, for instance, the World Economic Forum talks about the Great Reset. They talk about building back better. The concept of building back better is based on the idea, the thought that everything has been wiped out. There's been some scorched earth policy, the house burned down or whatever, and you're going to reconstruct your X, your economy system, your house or whatever. You're going to construct it. And as you reconstruct it, you're going to build back better. All of these people right now involved in this pandemic are the same people sponsored through and from and around the United Nations that sponsored the global warming alarmism debacle that we've seen for the last 15, 20 years. Same people, same universities, same types of computer models that are being used to scare the pants off everybody and create a system of fear. In every case, all of it is designed to drive people to one singular solution. There's never a plan B, there's only plan A, and that is sustainable development, which I very strongly believe is, we can call it neo-technocracy, it's historic technocracy on steroids. These are the people now in control. When the pandemic started, I saw the people involved on both sides of this coin. I said, this is fishy. Immediately, I knew it was fishy, that something was going on. I wrote that this was the beginning of the coup d'etat of the technocrats of the world. Their number one objective, and I just take this from literature. It's not me saying this. This is what I have seen in the literature. They are saying that, and their main target is the destruction of the economic system as we have known it for the last 150 years. That means capitalism, the monetary system, et cetera, is out. A new system is coming in. It's an otherworldly system. And the United Nations itself, just to tie it into some of our other speakers, the United Nations itself has said that the financial system that will be necessary to support sustainable development, that's technocracy, remember, is the whole area of fintech that we know that they collectively define as fintech. That's a basket of different technologies, including financial technologies, blockchain, digital currency, the collection of data from every conceivable corner of society. And altogether, fintech is designed to be the financial system to support this new great reset, if you will, this new sustainable development economic system. It's very nefarious, I'll warn you. One of my friends, I'm gonna close with this, one of my friends from that recently passed, unfortunately, her name is Rosa Corey, has spoken formerly extensively in the United States and Europe as well, about Agenda 21 and about sustainable development and the plans that they have orchestrated for the entire planet. And she concluded most of her talks that she gave with this statement. And I like this statement because it's just short, a few words, and it really expresses the whole nut of the thing. She says, "It is the inventory and control plan for all land, all water, all minerals, all plants, all animals, all construction, all means of production, all food, all energy, all information, and all human beings in the world." That's pretty blunt. This is where this is headed right now, towards scientific dictatorship, if you will. But it's coming on like an express train. Now the second wave is taking place right now. It's all based, of course, on the pandemic idea, fear, and, you know, you do what we tell you to do and everything will be fine. But now the second wave is taking place. The economic destruction is going to be much greater than it was with the first round in 2020. And I believe we're going to see a repeat. We're going to see more businesses going out of business. We're going to see the monetary system, the kind of the old monetary system, flying out of control. And demands will be called for this, you know, the new area of fintech essentially to take over and to control everything from kind of the organic level, if you will. I'm going to stop with that. I know it's a lot to say in a short period of time, and it's new to a lot of people. They just haven't heard these terms before. But I will say that the concept of technocracy is being discussed and talked about more in the world today than it ever has in the past. And that's a good thing. There's more discussion on it. There's more research going into it. There's more visibility and awareness, especially with the pandemic, that this may be exactly what's going on. I suggest that it is. So thank you for your time. I appreciate all of you guys and everything that you're bringing to the table.
And thank you, Dr. Patrick Wood. Before we do close out on this session and then move on to the next, I would like to get a comment from our two other panelists on these two presentations. I will first start with Catherine Austin Fitz. All right, I do not see Catherine. Oh, there she is.
Catherine, can you hear us? Maybe she can't hear us, I'm afraid.
Okay, we will then go to Catherine.
There she is.
I'm here, sorry.
Go ahead, Catherine.
So I thought both were excellent because both Mark and Patrick are describing the push for centralization and the extraordinary economic impact it's having. And as I listen to them, I think of two things. One is I used to have a pastor who would say, if we can face it, God can fix it. And it's a lot to hear that a global coup d'etat is underway, but it is. And I think it really helps to face it, and it brings the people together who'd like to see something else. The other thing I could say is that if there's anything I've learned by studying the economy over the last 30 years, it's that this central control is very destructive of the economy. And in fact, there is no reason on this planet for poverty. There's no reason. This cannot be turned around as an economic matter. If you run an economy with this tight central control, it's hugely destructive. But instead, if you find a way to do a reset, but a reset that ends with human freedom, there's no economic reason why it cannot work. So even though facing the coup is a very difficult thing, be assured that there is no reason we can't do a very different, I'll call it the people's reset. The economic opportunity is there. Freedom is far more productive and successful.
All right, Catherine, thank you for that. And lastly, Professor Werner, any final comments on the previous two presentations?
Well, I concur with Catherine's comments. There's no reason why we can't have a better system in terms of the possibility and the economic possibilities for us and the future of mankind. In fact, we can have very high, sustainable, non-inflationary, equitable economic growth in every country in the world, and there doesn't need to be any poverty whatsoever. Can be implemented very quickly within a number of maybe 2-3 years in almost any country. But unfortunately, the revealed preference of the decision makers has been of a very different kind, and policies are taken that do not achieve those goals that are good for the majority of the population, but instead seem to be just useful for those who want to centralize power and control. And then they use fairly weak economic arguments to justify this. So I think we need to all work on educating people so they realize that, you know, these widely used mainstream official economic arguments are false. Mostly they can be empirically disproven very quickly. In fact, the entire post-Second World War economic development paradigm centering on the IMF and the World Bank has been not just a failure, as we all know, because there is no developing country that has actually developed in any meaningful sense, moved from developing country status to developed country status in those 70 years. But actually, these policies have been designed in order to keep countries down and prevent economic development. And the only countries that have moved decisively from developing country status to developed country status are those that have done the diametrically opposed set of policies to IMF and World Bank policies, namely Japan, Korea, Taiwan, and since 1978, China. And therefore, we do need to keep in mind that we need to be optimistic. The world can be a much better world, but it clearly seems to be our power. But at the same time, there's a lot of misinformation out there. And as long as people get better informed about reality and the facts, they can see through the propaganda, and then we can start to rebuild the world, not in the reset type of rebuilding, as Mr. Globalist likes it, but in the way that it actually becomes a better society that's benefiting the majority of the population.
All right, thank you. And now I would like to take the time to welcome back all of the panelists from session two. While we have pointed out many of the problems and the issues that we face economically and financially, I think now is a really good opportunity to start talking about solutions. So again, I would like to invite everyone back on who participated in session two. I'm first going to start with Catherine Austin Fitz. Talk about for us the importance of positivity and the importance of also providing real solutions. I know that you have been working on one particular initiative, Cash Friday. So if you would like to speak about that and why you chose to get involved in that.
So Cash Friday came out of a wonderful meeting we had with Children's Health Defense several weeks ago. And I was talking about the danger of the vaccine passports being adopted in a way that would give tight control to central bank digital currencies. And the wonderful Mary Holland, who will be with us tomorrow, said, I was saying it's very important that we maintain a high cash balances in circulation and we don't go all digital. And Mary said, because, you know, in America, we all know about dressing down on Friday or eating fish on Friday. She said, well, why don't we have a Cash Friday? And everybody in the whole room said, that's great. So what we've asked our networks to doing, and we hope we spread it globally, on Friday, just use cash. Just use cash. Let's see if we can't dramatically increase the use of cash. We also, if you come to Solaria, we have a silver and gold payment calculator, because I've said to people, look, just circulate your coins. Let's not buy into an all digital system, because it's when we go all digital that you get these kind of complete controls. So Richard talked a lot about the importance of decentralizing the banking, which is critical. If we can get the number of local banks and credit unions growing dramatically, that's going to be great for a decentralized economy. The more we can do to centralize cash, currency, equity, and economic activity locally, the more powerful transformation we can make in changing these things.
Professor Werner, I'll give you a chance to respond to that. I know you did touch on it earlier in your establishing and supporting community banks, but can you talk in a further depth as to why you chose to take on this initiative and how it relates to your other work and research?
Yes, absolutely. Well, actually, there has been a movement that started already, 150 years ago, towards decentralization. And it's a movement known as the cooperative movement, which has as its fundamental pillars decentralization and placing power in the hands of local people. So the fundamental principles are self-administration, self-responsibility, and self-initiative by local people. So it's not some central planner telling people what to do. It is local people getting organized. And that's a general principle. This cooperative principle can be implemented across all sectors, clearly not just banking, although there's the largest number of banks in Europe is the cooperative banks. Germany has most of those, almost 1,000, and they've been performing exceptionally well. They're very entrepreneurial, but at the same time, they are local stakeholder banks run by local, the local community. But it's not just banking, as I said, it's across all industries. So we've seen in recent decades energy cooperatives springing up in many countries as new forms of sustainable energy or other forms of energy are being put online. Who owns this? Who controls this? Well, why not the local community? And can be organized in such a way. And it can be essentially almost any service or economic activity can be designed in a cooperative fashion, whereby the local community are really the principals, and they share the responsibility. They're active, and this really then means that these businesses are accountable in a meaningful sense, because they are small scale and you can see what they're doing. They're part of the local community. They're accountable to the local community. And then you get essentially true democracy, because people have some influence. They can shape things and their lives and their surroundings. But when things get more concentrated, all the institutions get bigger and bigger. The major disadvantage is that you can't control them. They become unaccountable. Nobody knows what is happening. And of course, then we get all the various problems, and the weaknesses of human nature start to show, whether it's corruption in a direct sense or in a very indirect sense. All these things happen when organizations get too large. So I'm very much with the principle of small is beautiful, and local communities. Now, in my work, this has essentially been one of the empirical results that I've shown that such decentralized structures and cooperative structures deliver superior performance in many ways. And there's a number of reasons for that. I've already mentioned that the main employer everywhere are small firms, but small firms are only able to be viable and upgrade to latest technologies and therefore stay competitive if they get funding. But only small banks, local small banks, will be willing and able to lend to them and help them. So, and this is true also for other service providers, that essentially the more you have this decentralized structure with lots of small players locally based, the better everything is, and ultimately the more sustainable and also the more resilient things are. So it's sort of a theme across my work, which, by the way, since you asked about my work, fundamentally is empirically based. People ask me, what school of economics do you follow, whatever. Well, I don't follow any school of economics. If you want to call it a school of thought, it's simply empirical economics. Or you could even say, perhaps slightly provocatively, scientific economics, because the mainstream is based on the idea that you just pose an axiom, which is something you know to be true for sure, so you never have to check whether it's true. And if you did check, you'd find out it's not true. That's an axiom. And then you add assumptions, which you know from the start are not true, but you don't care. And that's the deductive, hypothetical, axiomatic approach, which is essentially charlatanism and totally unscientific. That's mainstream economics for you. And so I've done the radical thing of saying that there's no reason why we can't have scientific research methodologies also in economics. And that's how I operate, just looking at the facts and what I described, a decentralized, locally based, small scale, sort of locally grounded system being superior is an empirical fact that we should be aware of and we should take advantage of.
All right, thank you. Dr. Skidmore, I see that you have a comment or some thoughts to share, so why don't you go ahead?
Sure, I just wanted to back up Professor Warner's comments. I also have done some work on decentralization in the context of disasters, and you have this great opportunity to improve resilience, to allow communities to try different things and learn from each other. You also know that a one size doesn't fit all. And so, in the United States, we still have a lot of autonomy at the state and local levels. And what you see is a tremendous variety of policies, in response to the pandemic. And then you have an opportunity for people to vote. Right now, I think we have a challenge with our our voting mechanism, but they can certainly vote with their feet. And we're seeing that. So all of what Professor Warner said, I would just concur with and thank him for those comments.
Thank you.
And what about you, John Titus? I know that you referenced Professor Warner's work in your piece that you shared with us earlier and the importance of decentralization in using cash. So any other comments that you have for us this evening?
You're muted, John. Unmute yourself, please.
You're muted.
Okay.
Well, I'm unmuted now. I would say, yes, I am a big fan of Professor Warner's work. He does take a scientific approach, and he doesn't follow schools of thought in economics, thankfully, because as he says, Main Street economics is charlatanism. I would add, though, that my concern is not, I'm not an economist, I'm a lawyer. And the thing that bothered me and has bothered me for a long time, and I alluded to it, and I just talked about it in my presentation in front, is the disappearance of the rule of law. And I first noticed this had happened in early 2013. I set up a YouTube channel in 2014, because the disappearance of the rule of law means that the law is no longer top dog, that you now have the rule of man. And that is, I don't think anybody would ever say that has been, true all along. But the disappearance in 2013 that I'm talking about is the open acknowledgement that there are people who are above the law and institutions, namely banks, that are above the law, and that they can commit crimes, whatever they want to, and not be prosecuted for, because supposedly to do so would endanger the monetary system and endanger the financial system. And that is a very toxic, a very dangerous notion that elevates banks above ordinary people. And that was bound to have a bad outcome. And we're facing it right now. So what's the remedy for that? If you look at the founding documents of U.S., it's the Declaration of Independence and it's the U.S. Constitution. They're both premised on the rule of law. So when you have gotten rid of the rule of law, in essence, you have, what has happened is that you have reversed the American Revolution. And the only way to get that back, but there's been a coup d'etat, and that term has been used any number of times. I fully agree with that, but I agree with it really in the legal sense that it's really the law now is really just a tool used to oppress people. And I see that very clearly. And I think a lot of people see that very clearly. And what's happened during these lockdowns, they're very draconian. They're very whimsical. They're arbitrary and capricious. They are enforced, at a whim, and they always benefit the billionaire class. And so we are now operating in an environment without the rule of law. And the way to get that back, unfortunately, the only way to get that back, if you read history, is a revolution, the counter-revolution. I mean, and Alexander Del Mar, who for my money was probably the greatest monetary historian of all time, said, the American Revolution really wasn't about, it really wasn't about Lexington and Concord. It was really about the refusal of American colonists to use the Bank of England's monetary system, because it was a debt-based system and it was very oppressive. And the revolution really was the colonists' use of their own money. So I think solutions like using cash on Fridays is a major step in the right direction, but we needed to make a lot more. I think the more time you spend trying to operate within the meets and bounds of the current system, you're playing into the hands of the criminals who are running that system now. And we need to start thinking about solutions that are outside of the system, like using our own currencies and creating our own currencies. That happened thousands of times over and over again during the Great Depression, local communities using their own currencies. And so, like Professor Warner suggests, yeah, it's going to be, have to be small community-based institutions that they're going to be the laboring oar and what's to come. But I think that the we're in a very serious trap right now, and there really aren't too many solutions to get out, unfortunately. But solutions like Cash Friday, like I say, that's a step in the right direction. And that's really what I have to comment there.
Okay, thank you, John, for that insight. Dr. Patrick Wood, I could see you shaking your head. So are there any final comments that you have or any more statements that you want to follow up on regarding your own presentation? And you're muted.
We do need a counter-revolution, in a sense, to try and turn the tide on this globalist onslaught that's it's in every country. It's not just America. It's not just France. Not just Germany. It's everywhere. That's part of the problem. People in every country need to take action these days and try and do things to push back. One of the things that I've been greatly concerned about as one who is a constitutionalist, I respect and revere the U.S. Constitution as a system of government, is that free speech and the concept, which is embedded in the concept of the First Amendment, free speech is absolutely essential, not only just for human progress, kind of in a larger sense, but in any particular group of people. Free speech is what produces ideas, and it produces relationships, it produces wisdom. We have lost this. This is under attack all over the planet, and especially in America, we see it with massive censorship of doctors and medical professionals. Anybody's got anything commonsensical to say, they're shut down before they can even say it. Media's had been taken over. This is a marker of a revolution taking place. Revolutionaries always go after the media first. They take over radio, TV, newspapers, and this has happened in the Bolshevik Revolution all the way up through Rhodesia, Mozambique, the sub-Saharan African revolutions. It's always the media first. They're going after media right now and the shutting down communication. If we lose the ability to communicate, like we're communicating right now, this is a blessing for sure for a lot of people, but we have the ability to speak our mind openly without fear of shame, rebuttal, censorship, whatever. But let me tell you, the windows are narrowing in every possible venue. And so we have been just kind of actively, and I won't say desperately, but I could say it, okay, we're desperately trying to get people back to where they start, open their mouth again with constructive communication in their own communities to restore their belief systems and their ideas into their local communities again. That's why I started Citizens for Free Speech 4 years ago now. And especially since the pandemic hit, our membership now has absolutely exploded. We're well over 30,000 nationwide members in the United States. And people are understanding now more and more, hey, it's up to me. Don't look at the government. Don't look at the president, Congress, anybody else. It's up to us individually now to take a role in restoring and turning this thing around. And it must start at the local level, in my opinion. And I think a lot of the comments we've heard already kind of reinforce that. But in the end of it, it's all based on our ability to communicate with each other. If we lose that ability to communicate, we're really cooked. So this is something we want to hang on to.
All right, thank you. And I want to thank all of you for participating on this segment. And I want to